Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, we start with a report about Western China. Then, Phil Deerking presents this week's education tips. Steve Ember has another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first,
nobody knows what happened to a Uyghur student after he returned to China from Egypt and was taken away by police. Not his neighbors, not his classmates, not even his mother. "Is he dead or alive?" the mother asked when an Associated Press reporter visited her home and showed her a photo of her son. Tears ran down her face. Friends of the student believe that he is one of thousands of people who have been taken away without trial into new re-education centers. The disappearances began in the past year. They are part of efforts by Chinese officials to use detentions and electronic surveillance to create a police state over the Xinjiang area and its 10 million Uyghurs. Uyghurs are a Turkic-speaking, mostly Muslim minority. The Chinese government says Uyghurs have been influenced by Islamic extremism.
Police are everywhere in Xinjiang. High-tech surveillance systems track where Uyghurs go, what they read, who they talk to, and what they say. Through rare interviews with Uyghurs who recently left China, government reports, and a visit to southern Xinjiang, the Associated Press reported on a campaign that is meant to remove terror but is instead causing fear. Most of the more than a dozen Uyghurs the AP interviewed asked to be unnamed because they feared that Chinese officials would punish them or their family. The AP did not name the Uyghur student or report other personal information in order to protect people from possible punishment. The Xinjiang government did not answer repeated requests for comment from the AP. The national government describes its Xinjiang security measures as a strike-hard campaign. They say its actions are necessary, following a series of attacks in 2013 and 2014. Among them was a mass knife attack at a train station that killed 33 people. The Chinese government also notes its years of heavy economic investment in Xinjiang, cultural assimilation programs, and preferred college acceptance for Uyghurs.
Officials describe the mass detention programs as vocational training. The training centers on Mandarin, law, ethnic unity, de-radicalization, and patriotism. The programs can last from 3 months to 2 years. The AP visited one such center in the southern city of Korla. A sign on the center called it a jail. Another one was along a street blocked off by police. Southern Xinjiang is one of the most heavily policed places in the world. In Hotan, police stations are set up every 500 meters. Sometimes groups of more than 40 armored police cars drive down city streets. Police checkpoints on every other city block stop cars to check identification. Police also check citizens' smartphones for religious materials.
But much of the policing goes unseen. One government program appears to have three-dimensional pictures, voice data, genetic material, and fingerprints, according to a public security document. The document's full contents remain a secret. However, the AP found at least three contracts that made note of purchase orders for equipment such as microphones and voice analyzers.
Uyghurs now living in other countries say it is too risky to contact their families still in China. When Salih Hudayar, an American Uyghur graduate student, last called his grandfather this summer, the man told him kindly not to call again. He later heard his grandfather had been sent to a re-education camp. A Uyghur student who moved to Washington said that after his move, his wife, a government worker still in Xinjiang, sent him a message that said the police would show up at her home in 20 minutes. She had to say goodbye. After that, she would permanently remove him from her contacts list. Later, he could not help but make one last call to his home. His daughter answered the phone. "Mom is sick, but she doesn't want me to speak to you," she told him. "Goodbye."
In today's education tips, we discuss what teachers can do to help manage large classes. We will also look at ways to increase student participation. People have different ideas about what makes a class too big. Some studies consider a classroom with more than 30 or 35 students a large class. Other studies say that a class with more than 60 students is considered large. Education professor Penny Ur says she considers a class to be too large if the teacher is unable to help the students make the progress they should be making. Teaching a large class can bring both positive and negative experiences. Some teachers report that students misbehave more often in big classes. The teachers may also find it hard to provide feedback on every student's work. It can also be hard for the students. Larger classes often include students with different ability levels. Stronger students, then, may feel bored. Weaker students may feel left behind. But large classes can present positive opportunities as well. Natalie Hess, an education researcher, says that large classes offer a chance for interactive activities. They also provide students with a chance to help other students in class, as well as learn independently. Here are some tips to help students manage a large class. Researchers suggest creating a list of classroom rules with feedback from the students themselves. If students are part of such a process, they are more likely to follow rules for class. Dapak Sabankili is a high school English language teacher in Togo. He told VOA that he makes agreements with his students about the rules and what should happen when students break the rules. He then puts the list of rules on a wall in the classroom for everyone to see. Organization is extremely important with large groups of students and keeping them focused. Start each class with an agenda for the day. When students know the plan for each class, they may be less likely to misbehave. It also helps to have a method for getting students' attention if the class starts to get noisy. This may include a quiet signal, such as raising your hand, or a word or phrase that you say with your class. Students may lose interest if class activities last for too long. This is especially true with large classes. Therefore, teachers should plan to have many different activities with different levels of difficulty. This helps keep the class moving at a quick speed and helps prevent students from feeling bored. In large classes, there is simply not enough time for a teacher to work with each and every student. In order to give students enough of a chance to practice English in class, teachers should consider organizing the class in pairs or groups. Pair and group work can help make a large class feel smaller for students. Such work also gives them more opportunities to participate in class. When forming groups for group work, it helps to give each student a role. These roles may include note taker, timekeeper, leader, or presenter. Roles help students stay focused. They also give the students a sense of responsibility. Teachers can give one assignment or project for the group to turn in for a group grade. One useful group activity is called a jigsaw. This is where each member of a group works on a certain part of an assignment. After finishing the task, each student shares his or her work with the group. For example, each member in a group reads a different part of an English story or article. After finishing their part, each student explains or summarizes for the group the section that he or she read. With large classes, teachers must spend a lot of time correcting all the students' assignments. One effective tool is to have students exchange papers and correct each other's work while the teacher calls out the answers. Teachers can also have students discuss answers with each other before answering questions or work on assignments in pairs. Dapak says that he does a think-pair-share activity with his classes. First, the teacher asks the class a question or gives out an assignment. Then, students first have time to think about the question themselves, then the students discuss their own ideas with a partner. Finally, the students share their answers with the class or with the teacher. In many classrooms around the world, teachers often do most of the talking during class while the students listen and take notes. Students may not be familiar with pair or group work. They may feel uncomfortable or not understand the purpose of such work. If this is the case, students must be slowly trained to do interactive activities. Teachers can begin by having students work in pairs for very simple class activities. As they become more comfortable with the work, teachers can slowly increase the difficulty of the activities that students work on together. Teachers should take the time to discuss with their class the importance of pair and group work in large classes. Kwan Warapatsu, an English teacher in Thailand, says she spends time before activities discussing with her students why it is good for them to work together in class and how it can help them improve their English. If students better understand the importance of working together, they will be more willing to do it and likely have fewer behavioral problems during class. Managing large language classes is not easy, but with a little extra preparation, teachers and students can have a successful, meaningful experience. I'm Phil Dierking.
From VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a secretary of state who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a secretary of the treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a secretary of war who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as Commander-in-Chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address, urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Furling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented. And the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.